Hello, I'm Adam Ferner.
And I'm Darren Chetty.
And welcome to Do You Even Vegan? This is the final episode of this season of Do You Even Vegan, a podcast in which Darren and I discuss matters of a vegan nature and how they relate to issues of broader concern. In the following episode, we talk about the season just gone, and in particular, reflect on the interviews we conducted with Eva Meyer, Gary Francione, and Syl Coe. Have a listen, or don't. There's no obligation, but unless you press stop, it's going to play automatically. What a year.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
I mean, this is funny, isn't it? Well, no, it's not funny at all. What am I? That's a terrible note to start on. Can edit that out.
I don't know what you're going to say now.
Well, I mean, this podcast really started almost by accident with us recording in my kitchen because the Veg Fest had been called off.
Yeah.
Because of this outbreak of a virus. And even in the week leading up to it, we thought we'd probably be okay with Veg Fest. It looks like things might get worse, but probably, you know,
yeah,
at this point it'll be fine. And maybe in a couple of weeks, things are going to be getting postponed.
I was ready and raring to go.
Yeah, raring to go. And it also happened for our How to Disagree. We had our big event at Amnesty with 1,000 people lined up to see us with Nasreen Malik and Gary Young.
And then things got worse.
Exactly. I mean, at the time, that seemed like a terrible, you know, tragedy that we missed that event. And everything that's happened since has put it into context.
Have your thoughts about food changed dramatically since whenever it was that we started recording, which I believe was in, it must have been in March, start of March?
Yeah, I guess one thing that the pandemic has brought to my attention even more so is if people are going through stuff, if people are struggling, then trying to get them to adhere to new sort of moral guidelines can come across as you know, not being particularly helpful.
It's kind of like kicking people when they're down.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm having a terrible time. Do I really need to think about this as well?
Yeah, and I think the thing that I'm coming more, I don't think I've changed my mind on things hugely, although I've tried to be open to that. I'm not sure, and I've always succeeded. But I think it's brought into focus more to me that if you care about the welfare of non-human animals, you're going to need to care about the welfare of human animals. And what's more, if you don't already do that, then you possibly, well, you should be interrogating why that is. So
I think that's right.
Well, I was going to say, I've always had this frustration, I guess, you know, from my early sort of involvement with the animal rights movements, with how they would do anything for the animals and yet not be so concerned with people, and certainly with, you know, people in far-flung places, that it seems weird how you'd be so concerned with animals and not with people. And equally that I've had this sort of sense when I've been in anti-racist spaces where I'm not going to bang on about being vegan because it won't be welcomed. And even in some cases, it will make me seem slightly questionable as an anti-racist, and, you know, in some sort of less thought out ways, that it'll make me seem rather sort of white liberal bourgeois not an anti-racist radical who's looking for, you know, a deep change in society towards a more just world.
I guess we've also been having more conversations with people, especially over this last series, and we've had longer episodes talking in greater depth to people like Nina, mm-hmm, and of course Mel and Hannah,
mm,
and then more recently, last week indeed, we spoke to Gary Francione, Eva Meyer and Syl Coe, and Syl Coe spoke wonderfully, I thought, in relation to the topics you've just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. What did you take from listening to Syl or chatting with Syl?
Well, so one of the things that I thought was brilliant about Syl was how welcoming her veganism was. So Eva Meyer and Gary Francione seemed like they had quite a hardline approach. And Gary particularly, who thinks that, you know, vegetarianism is inconsistent and hardly better than meat eating. But I thought that Syl was much more permissive in her approach to veganism,
precisely because she was foregrounding the wider political issues in the way that I think that you're describing. Mm-hmm. So it's not just about what food you put in your mouth, it's about what other socially progressive movements you're engaged in, was how I interpreted what she was saying.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I mean, I think you might be right. I think we've said already, it'd be great to talk to all our guests, but to Syl on this one further, to really get a sense of that. Because I think there's sort of questions of how we theorise our relationship or what it means to be a human in relation to other humans and in relation to non-human animals. And then there are questions of strategy, of if we have some sort of vague notion of the world we'd like to live in, how we might yeah. sort of bring that about. And I think you and I are often quite interested, as we always reference Carnage, you know, and I've described it as a sort of a playful blueprint for how social change might happen. But I wondered whether in some of those conversations, the three people we spoke to, the breakfast, lunch and dinner, there was less of a sort of engagement with the how will we get there, because they're philosophizing and they're doing the theorizing. Did you get that sense as well?
I think that was definitely true of the conversations that we had. But unlike Eva and Gary, I mean, Gary, it feels like his line is, we just need to argue with more people and I'll persuade them. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, you know, it sounds like he's been successful in the people that he's talked to about it, but hasn't ever worked for me. But with Syl, we didn't get to it in the conversation itself, but in the book, in Afroism, which, as we discussed, was co-written with her sister, Af, there is at least a kind of gesturing towards a project of a creative, imaginative project of trying to flesh out the conceptual space for us as people interested in veganism to inhabit. I mean, you know, that's something that they in the book tie to Afrofuturism. Mm-hmm. And I would love to be able to speak to her more about that, or indeed both of them, because I think that being able to conceptualize that future, exactly as you say, is a step beyond diagnosing the problem, and an important step.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess with Gary, there was this... There's a commitment to non-violence, which I find really interesting, because I've sort of gone through my stage in life of thinking, oh, non-violence, that's just so naive, you know, to thinking that there's something quite profound in a commitment to non-violence. Something difficult to work out, but the fact that he has that commitment and then says, you know, veganism is part of that, or is, what was his phrase he kept using? Yeah. Not the bottom line,
The moral baseline, was that
the moral baseline, yeah, the moral baseline. But then on top of that, he has a sort of very engaging, what I think to non-philosophers might seem like an in-your-face style of talking. So I think to you and I, who have you know, hung around philosophers, even if we might not use it
against
a term of self-description, you know what it's like when philosophers get going. There's almost this enjoyment in the, right, we're just purely into the battle, as we'd say in hip-hop. Whereas I think if you're not in that world, you think, what's going on here? So he has this non-violence, but he also has a very in-your-face rhetorical style, which I think works in the seminar room.
Yes.
I wonder how it works when you're engaging with people who aren't as committed to non-violence as you. But he's been at it long enough, he probably has those tales to tell if we were to dig deeper, I think.
Yes, and another thing that I'd like to dig deeper in relation to is his Jainism. So he's a Jain, and I think that the commitment to non-violence and the spiritual side of his moral position is really interesting, especially given the fact that in his written work, at least, mm-hmm. he pursues a very analytic line, which seems, if not anathema, then at least awkward next to the idea that there might be a spiritual dimension.
Mm-hmm. I think I struggle more with Ava's arguments. Well, I think partly she was done a disservice because the day is sort of branded as a day about veganism, and her book isn't really addressing veganism so much as looking at this idea that animals have language, animals communicate.
Yes.
And in fact, very early on in our conversation, she was clear to say that she wasn't sort of predicating veganism on the ability of animals to have language. She went more down Gary's line of them being sentient beings. So the language thing is an additional rather than a sort of fundamental argument for thinking about how we relate to animals. Is that how you understood it?
Yeah, and actually it was interesting in that regard because the way that I described her in a kind of summary at the start of the episode with her is to say that because we think animals are persons and we don't eat persons, we shouldn't eat animals. And she resisted the term person. And that, I thought, was particularly significant, especially in relation to the way that Gary uses person. So Gary, and you know, this is against the backdrop of me having done my PhD in analytic metaphysics, focusing on personhood. And the way that I read it, and I think ever objected to this, but the way that I read it was that animals are being construed as persons in both her and Gary's picture, and persons in that context is a very specific neoliberal understanding of what a person is. So it's a discrete, unified, sentient being. And that actually was something that I thought that Sill, certainly in the book, critiques in a really interesting way, because I think that the idea of treating animals as persons, to a certain extent, is self-undermining if you're arguing for widespread radical changes to attitudes to animals, because it relies on this neoliberal conception of what a person is and completely ignores the interrelations between communities. So that, I think, is one thing that all of the people that we spoke to would agree on, is that we are very much bound up with the lives of the creatures with whom we cohabit the earth,
mm-hmm.
and also other communities. I mean, like other human communities, the idea of all of these separate atomistic individuals kind of bumping around and occasionally eating each other is not going to be helpful if you want to pursue genuinely progressive social change. Okay. Does that make sense?
I struggle a little bit with that, and it's not the first time I've heard you say similar things, so I do think it's me.
Not so sure.
But my struggle is that Gary he's so keen to talk to you know your non-philosopher, non-vegan, and the language of personhood I don't think translates very well out of philosophy.
Right. Yeah.
That, you know, if you're on the street and you see a dog and you say, "Oh look, that's a person," people will laugh at you. Yeah. That it seems like.
Yeah.
It seems like such a nonsensical thing to say. If you said, "Oh, that's a creature that can suffer," people might think, "Ooh, that's a bit deep."
Yeah.
But they wouldn't laugh at you. They'd probably actually say, "Yeah, I could agree with you." So I just wonder about the sort of rhetorical move as much as the conceptual move of talking about things in terms of personhood.
Yes.
But yeah. I know that's not your issue with it.
That's not my beef.
That's not your tofu.
That's not my bone of contention.
Oh, gosh.
No, but I think that's a really relevant point, and I think it also intersects with another issue that we discussed quite a lot in those interviews, which was about the ways in which analogies can be productive but also in some ways destructive, and drawing comparisons between animals and human animals can be vexed, to say the least, at times. And person, I think, functions like that as a term to draw a comparison implicitly between non-human animals and human animals.
Oh, you think that's what's happening with that? So when I hear person and think of a human, that you don't think that's a mistake on my part? You think that's what the writer is intending to happen?
Possibly not intending, but I feel like it definitely is a rhetorical move, right? Because, as you say, we typically do talk about persons and we mean humans, unless you're in the rarefied environs of the academic seminar room. Normally, I think if we're saying like, "Oh yeah, person," we're not thinking of a duck.
Yeah. And I think this is part of my concern with the work, the project that Ava's on as well. Ironically, I do draw an analogy with my anti-racist work, but I know that a lot of sort of ill thought out multiculturalism basically goes, they're quite like us. You know, we need to treat them, you know, the sort of idea of, "Oh, Hanukkah, that's the Jewish Christmas. Diwali, that's the Hindu Christmas. Eid, that's the Muslim Christmas." And it's like, as long as we can talk about them in terms of reference of us, then we see that we should treat them well. And it's like, no, there's something really problematic about that.
Yes.
And I worry that actually is might be happening with our desire to talk about animals. And I know you talked about it as anthropomorphism in the book, and Ava said in the interview that there's this sort of contrary idea of anthro-denial, where, you know, we deny the similarities. But it is something that I think is happening at times.
I mean, I think that you don't have to be denying that non-human animals have sentience or a particular engagement in the world by saying that they're not like anthros, they're not like humans. Because, they're alien intelligences. We can't plumb those depths, I don't think, because I do think, as we discussed with Ava, that the way that we conceptualize the world is very much linked with the kinds of embodied beings that we are. I can't get on the same wavelength as a dolphin.
Yeah.
But not because they're not intelligent, but just because they've got blowholes and they spend all of their time under the water. And, you know, I mean, I guess those are things that I just can't wrap my head around.
And I think to make it really sort of visceral and bring it, come full circle to my slaughterhouse experience, when I saw that cow being slaughtered and sort of thrashing about and making very loud noises, I don't think it matters whether I'm conceiving of it sort of, you know, reflecting on its life, thinking of its children and what it's leaving behind, or just notice that it doesn't like this. This is painful. There is some suffering here that might not be like a human suffering, but there is some suffering here that is, you know, in our country right now, avoidable. And to me, this is the thing that makes, I don't know, to me that satisfies, well, just avoid it then.
Yeah.
Now, clearly, I'm not persuading everyone, but it just seems to me, that creature was suffering. Why do it? Stop doing it.
Yeah. I clearly find that compelling. However, I think one of the things that came out when we were talking to Gary is this idea that those arguments have limits.
Yeah.
I mean, arguments generally, and rational argumentation has a limit. And, you know, we might go and have these conversations and occasionally persuade people here and there. And it sounds like Syl did that. She described this encounter with a friend where she was like, oh, you know, maybe you should become a vegan. And then her friend said, oh, yeah, I'm going to become a vegan, which is great. I mean, I wish that were replicable. But that's not either your experience or my experience, typically, of talking about veganism. And I didn't feel like that resonated with Gary at all. It seemed like that was his experience.
Yeah, I think this is the bit that I said, you know, if we get to talk to Gary again, you'd want to sort of pull apart, because he seemed to, at moments, be very positive about his ability, through rational conversation, to point out the inconsistencies in meat eaters' thinking and to move them towards veganism.
Yeah.
You know, he said it might take a few hours, but we could get there. And yet we know globally that even though we've just had, you know, maybe a couple of years of veganism being cooler than ever, certainly in this country.
We are very cool, actually.
We are. We're cutting edge. But globally,
just not to interrupt you, but to interrupt you, but just for the listeners, I am currently wearing a beautiful top which was ordered and designed for me by Darren, which has, I can't remember exactly what it says on the front, and I can't see it, but it says
the Roger Crabb Society,
and it's got a picture of 17th century vegan extraordinaire Roger Crabb. He is 17th. Yeah, he's 17th century.
With the words herbs and roots coming from his mouth.
Never, as Darren says, has veganism been cooler.
Not since the 17th century.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've totally, totally.
I've knocked you off.
Gear shift. Globally speaking. Now, globally speaking, the more animals are being slaughtered year on year, that it's not as if the effect of the growth of the number of vegans is impacting the number of animals being slaughtered, because the meat industry is so, I was going to use the word efficient, but it almost feels wrong to, but so machine-like in its ability to kill, you know, huge numbers, and has made a lot of effort to open up new markets in Asia, for example, in parts of Asia where, even though there might not have been a commitment to vegetarianism, meat eating has traditionally not been an everyday or a twice a day thing.
Yeah.
They've just tried to shift human behaviour. You know, Gary going around having long conversations with people is no match for McDonald's advertising wing.
There's only one Gary Francione.
Well, yeah. But I do think something has, you know, when he says, well, I've been doing this for 40 years, and he seems quite confident that the way he's doing it is the best way, then it seems to me that he's really saying, well, the facts of the matter, we're really playing a long game here. And I guess we all, if we're vegan, think we're playing a long game. We're not expecting to see a vegan planet, you know, before we leave this planet.
Yeah.
But when you look at carnage, when you look at some of that work, you think, well, might there be other means than rationally debating someone until they're forced to acknowledge that they're morally inconsistent?
So here's a question for you. Chicken nuggets. That's my question.
That's not a question. Fish fingers, so, I think, would be a question because...
Fish fingers? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is questionable.
Clearly, so. No, they don't.
Okay, to extend my question, again, to take it full circle and back to the fake meats, which you know I love so much, how do you feel that the production of fake meats either helps or hinders the vegan movement? Because since we've been recording, I feel like there's been an increase in vegan meats. There's also been a huge interest, an increase in interest among non-vegan friends of mine. In, you know, there's a vegan butchers in London, inverted commas.
Yeah.
And there is this creation of the first lab-grown meat chicken nuggets. Yeah. Do you think that's positive or negative for the vegan movement?
I think that increase in vegan meat has largely been to meet the demand of you.
Yes.
But I think...
and they failed.
But, and this is this thing that, yeah, I did think about asking all our guests. I think it could be a really nice way of getting to what our fundamental ideas are. Because on the one hand, you know, I saw people on Twitter saying, well, look, clearly this is a good thing for veganism. But in as much as part of what we're doing as vegans is trying to stigmatize eating the flesh of murdered beings, then perhaps some level of disgust at that will be helpful.
Yeah.
You know, we don't live our lives through sort of, what do you call it, those decision branches.
Yes.
We often all operate with a shorthand of, no. You know, which if people want to go, oh, why do you think that? You might be able to actually unpack and articulate, but you're not doing that at every moment. So that level of, that's horrible. You know, we want that about racism. We want that about sexism. We want that about carnism.
I think I agree in principle. However, in practice,
you just can't resist
the idea that something. No, but I mean, it's not only that I can't resist it, but I also think that there is something about. I mean, taboo isn't quite the right word, but there's something about, oh my God, this is terrible for me, which is exactly one of the reasons why I like fake meats. And this is something that I mean, it's like the haggard food that I had occasionally and really just enjoyed like eating when I was little. So the fact that it's not good, the fact that also I'm kind of partly, it says a lot about me, but the fact that I'm also partly disgusted by it and then I'm just like, delicious.
Mm-hmm.
I think the desire matrix isn't constructed in such a kind of like binary way as...
No.
I like this, I don't like this.
No, I do agree with it. And that's why I think having the conversations is interesting, because I do think the moral arguments can sometimes be sort of removed from the world, a priori arguments.
Yeah.
And then you get to, okay, what's the actual experience of people who, on the one hand, have a commitment and on the other hand, like the taste, and how do they live with that?
Yeah,
I think that's an important part of thinking about it. I guess I'm... You know, there's a constant thing, I think, when we talk to, especially when we talk to vegan philosophers, is where do I position myself in all of this? And I think philosophically, I'm quite sympathetic to Gary's position that if you recognise something is wrong, you know, you should endeavour to behave accordingly. I wouldn't want to beat myself up or verbally beat up others who fall short, because I think part of the human experience is to fall short of our ideals.
Yes.
And I also think that the rational argument of pointing out inconsistent thinking isn't going to go far enough. It didn't go far enough in anti-racism. The idea that we can defeat racism by rationality and by promoting reasonableness.
Yeah.
It's still there in some circles, but it's clearly the case that that's not going to do the job.
So another background thought that kind of floated around the three interviews that we had was related to hope.
Mm.
Eva, I thought, didn't seem like she had much hope for the planet. And I think she might even have said as much. Gary seemed optimistic. And Syl, I wasn't sure. But I suppose I was wondering how hopeful you feel. And if you feel hopeful, why?
I think hope's a really difficult thing, because I think hope, you know, we might think of it as a sort of philosophical disposition, but it's often, you know, I don't think you can disentangle it from very human things like mood, you know, how are you feeling?
Right.
So, yeah. And I think if we're not careful, we build a whole philosophical view of the world out of what might be, you know, chemical imbalance, or it might just be going through a hard time. So it gets really difficult. As I say, I think I don't feel like we're going to see a vegan planet anytime soon. I do feel like we're moving towards it at a very slow pace. And with the backlash, I mean, we've seen the backlash in terms of, you know, the post-Super Size Me, the way that McDonald's had to do the healthy glow and the let's put some salads on there now. So the backlash is always going to be there. That's going to be part of that long game. But I do think there's value in the sort of ripple effect of, if you actually have values about life, then trying to live that as your life project and others seeing you live that and perhaps being affected by it in some way is a life well lived. You know, given that I'm not sort of subscribing to any deeper meaning of life, then it seems to me that that's a reasonably a good way to spend, you know, a few decades on the planet. I don't know if that's hopeful or not, Adam.
I'm not sure. I feel like there's something a little bit fatalistic about it, which I respect, but doesn't leave me feeling particularly optimistic. I suppose lying behind that question was, what ways do you see of people putting theory into practice? And what ways do you see people being persuaded to pursue a kind of more vegan outlook?
Well, I think, you know, I think it comes back again to those three things that I've identified, you know, that pushed me to become vegetarian. One was the lived experience of seeing the horrors of the meat industry. And I do think that that there needs to be some sensitivity, but reconnecting people with the fact of deliberate killing is worth doing.
Yeah.
I'm not saying, you know, like try and traumatize small children, but the way that we have sanitized and so disconnected ourselves from killing on the land also has coincided with the increase in meat consumption. That when there were small local farms and people saw what was going on, okay, they'd found a way to adjust and live to it, but they weren't as blasé as they are now.
Yeah.
So there's that. I think having friends, it was for me, so seeing people who are real people, you know, instead of the vegans, and are living their lives, I think provides a sort of, oh yeah, you can live like that. And the other was, for me, Peter Singer, was reading some stuff as well.
Yeah.
And I think for different people, the balance of that is going to be different. Not everyone wants to read a big treatise. Not everyone's going to go want the lived experience stuff. But I think if you have the three of those, then it would be helpful.
So tell me what you think about this thesis. Mm-hmm. I found it very compelling, the way that in Afroism, Syl and Afco demonstrated the connections between white supremacy, capitalism, and the meat industrial complex. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are some ethical positions that are easier to assume than veganism. I think that's clearly the case. And I wonder whether there is mileage. I mean, this instrumentalizes other socially progressive movements in a way that I'm not perhaps that comfortable with. And this is why I'm interested to know your thoughts on it. But say, for example, veganism would become a more compelling and persuasive ethical position if we were to draw connections, not comparisons, but connections between it and its ethical purview and, for example, prison abolitionism, the deconstruction of white supremacy, the critique of capitalism.
Well, this is interesting, and I wonder whether there's a difference in the UK and in North America here, because this is a question that came up where someone said, you know, is veganism political? And Syl was sort of, is it left wing? And Syl said she didn't think it was. And in fact, and I think, you know, I've no reason to doubt her that in North America there were sort of hardcore Republican Christian vegans. You know, I've seen some of them on Twitter, looking at Nando Vegan on the hashtag.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, I think, well, yeah, personally, I want to draw the connections. I want to draw the connections between justice, between, you know, I guess really about to what extent can we develop non-coercive relationships with other beings?
Yeah.
And that seems to me something that is a worthwhile project. At the same time, when you lay it out like you just did, there's a real risk when we talk about strategy of you effectively raising the bar for entry into veganism, which is like, okay, it's no longer are you eating honey, are you wearing silk, it's are you also working to abolish prisons, are you dismantling white supremacy on a daily basis, what are you doing, etc., etc.
I feel like that's I'd be happy with that bar to be raised in that way.
Well, I think if what it does is it makes more people do those things, that's one thing. If what it does is it just turns more people off getting involved because they just think, well, this is just far too much or too much politically, or they don't agree with every tenet, so therefore they wholesale reject.
Yeah.
Then perhaps not. So, I mean, again, it would depend whether what we're really trying to do is a sort of a minimize suffering, or we want adherence to the moral baseline, and if you're not doing that, then, you know, what was it Gary said of himself when he was eating cheese? I realised I had no value as a person, or something, I think.
Yeah.
He said this in the sort of, you know, relaxed roundup, but we thought, hang on a minute, if that's how critical you are of yourself, is that also how you're viewing people around you?
Yeah.
And to some people that can be really off-putting, you know.
I suppose my thought was more that there are people that I talk to who are committed anti-racists who eat meat. And were I to say, look, if you're genuinely engaged in challenging the structures that support these racist projects, maybe that involves not eating meat. Maybe that involves taking a step back from those forms of animal production.
Yeah. I think that's great, but I think Simon Amstel called it correctly in having, you know, a South Asian man and a black man as the people leading this, is that if veganism is going to make inroads in the anti-racist movement, it's going to be vegans of colour who do that.
Right, yes.
Vegans of colour who won't be subjected to the criticism that Gary's been subjected to, as he said, of here we go again, a white man telling us how we should be doing things.
Yeah, I mean, an obvious, that's a position I also inhabit. And yes, I think that would be a problem.
And as much as I'm, you know, very critical of this sort of stay in your lane, you know, the sort of extreme idea of you can only speak from, you know, from your position and you're not entitled to talk, I think the situation on the ground is that it just becomes a lot harder, and that where we have vegans of colour who are both holding anti-racists and vegans to account is where we'll make progress.
No, I agree. I'm also noticing that it has been flashing low battery on my recorder for a while now, despite me just having put new batteries there.
That's more than enough.
Yeah, but what's a nice way of rounding up? What have you particularly enjoyed this year in terms of vegan food? That's my final question for this series of Do You Even Vegan?
Don't know.
Well, I was hoping that you were going to say, oh, some of the delicious cakes that you've been making.
This guy keeps coming round with chocolate cakes, yeah?
Yeah, also maintaining social distance, it must be
said. Yeah, yeah. And they're getting pretty good. They're getting pretty good. I'd say they're getting so good that I've probably put on about 10 kilos this year.
Yeah. It feels a bit forced now that I've told you to compliment me on the cakes that I've been making you. But I'll take it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm very happy with the compliment. Thank you.
And as I've never offered you any food, what would you say?
I'd say the vegan cakes that I've been making.
Well, that's good.
So that's the end of this season of Do You Even Vegan, I guess.
Well, I think so, yeah. I think we'll pause it. But of course, we're just 10 days away from Veganuary.
Veganuary, so let's, yeah. Depending on when this airs.
Okay, as we sit here and talk, yeah. So we should put these out for Veganuary and transform the world.
And if you're not persuaded, you're not rational. That can be our tagline.
I don't think that's going to work.
That's it. That's our series. Many thanks to Earthbound Boy for the music, to our contributors, and to you all for listening. If you want to get in touch, message us on Twitter, at DYEV1621. Darren's handle is at Rap Classroom, and he loves getting messages about veganism, especially if they're from vegan footballer extraordinaire Neil Robinson. And see you perhaps for another series of Do You Even Vegan in a future where restaurants are no longer illegal.